Today we have the great fortune of having as a guest with us once again His Grace, His Holiness, Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, who has been putting into practice in his life the activities of Krishna consciousness for over 30 years now, by the instructions of his spiritual master, who is A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who brought the teachings to the West in 1965. And Ravindra, because of his steady devotion on this path, has been continuing in his service, and he receives realizations from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so it is very profound for us to be able to receive from a spiritual practitioner the understanding of the purpose of humanity, so to speak. So Ravindra is going to kindly give us an understanding of the meaning of Dharma, which is a very misunderstood term that is also a Sanskrit word, and it has been translated in very many ways. So Ravindra is going to give us a clear understanding of the meaning of the term Dharma.
Thank you, Ekanta. It's good to be here again. When I was a teenager, I read a novel by Jack Kerouac called The Dharma Bums. And that was the first time I think I ever heard that that word, the Dharma Bums, which led to a real misunderstanding, I think, of what Jack Kerouac didn't have any idea what it really meant. But it's a pretty familiar word now to most English-speaking people. It may even be in the English dictionary by now, like yoga and mantra, and these kinds of words taken from Sanskrit. Usually people's idea of Dharma now is of some kind of a religion or a particular religious practice. Although the word is sometimes, and appropriately, translated as law. One translator of the Mahabharata all throughout translated the word Dharma as law with a capital L, which gets one aspect of it, but not the rest of it. Sometimes religion, or by which people mean a particular faith. But if we look at the root meaning, the Sanskrit root meaning, dharma comes from a verbal root meaning to sustain or to uphold. So dharma really means that which makes something what it is. It's essential nature that gives it its defining characteristic. And this really means that dharma cannot be changed. It's what you essentially are here. The dharma of sugar is to be sweet. In that sense, you say the religion of sugar is to be sweet. If we understand religion in that sense, then it's okay use of the word religion. The religion of fire is to be hot. It's just what they have to do. And so, according to the Vedas, we have, as spiritual beings, we have a dharma, an innate, unchangeable thing that, to which we actually, it's our religion. We can't convert from what is our dharma. See, if you can change from Islam to Christianity, or from Hindu to Buddhist or whatever, then that's not dharma, because dharma can't be changed. So it's what something essentially is, and so all these kind of sectarian and historical differences are on a very superficial level. So when the issue of dharma becomes discussed in one particular text we've studied called Srimad Bhagavatam, And it opens with a dialogue among some sages at the Naimisharanya forest, traditionally dated 5,000 years ago. So the sages have gathered to perform sacrifice, and they get the chance to hear from a very elevated personage named Suta Goswami, and they placed him on a number of questions. And one of those questions had to do with an issue that's an issue today. There are so many different scriptures and they say different things. So how then are we to understand what is the paro dharma, that is the highest dharma for all human beings? So when he answered this question, he said that dharma is the highest for all people, by which one attains bhakti, pure devotion, to Ahoksaja. Ahoksaja is the name of the transcendent Lord. It means he who's beyond the range of our mental speculation and our sense perception. And for this, by which you can attain bhakti. Bhakti is another important word. Usually, well, Prabhupada translates it as loving devotional service. It's love toward the Supreme, but also it involves a sense of activity, doing something. It's not just passive. In fact, it's active and it's in a reciprocal relationship. The word bhakti comes from a Sanskrit verbal root bhaj, which means to share, to participate. So bhakti is a way of entering into a relationship of sharing with the divine and becoming part of the divine life by performing devotional service to the transcendent Lord. Then it says, what is the standard of this bhakti? And Suta Goswami says that this bhakti should be ahaituki and apratiyata. Ahaituki means literally that it has no cause, which means to say that we are not doing it for any personal motive. It is not that I'm serving Hoksaja because I want something back. It's not a business deal. It's not giving in order to receive sort of thing. No, it's because it's love. And actual love may be rare enough, but when it's there, the characteristic of love is that one wants to satisfy the beloved, and when the beloved is satisfied, then you are satisfied. You don't require anything more. The happiness of the beloved is your happiness. Period. It's not that you require something back.
The first thing that comes to my mind when you have made the statement that a person can convert from Christianity to Islam or from Buddhism to Hinduism or so many other different faiths that are out there, but that doesn't change their dharma. The first thing that comes to my mind is the idea that then it must be a matter of personal interpretation that has caused these different paths of spirituality to take on various aspects, and that could very possibly be what is causing so much division in the world today. I'm really inspired to see you having so much involvement with interfaith groups, and I know that you've been doing this for a number of years now, I wonder if you can give us some hope and shed some light on our path as to how religions can better work together, or different people from different faiths can work together, and do we all share a karma dharma?
Well,
you ready?
Yeah. Our conviction is that all living beings belong to the same religion, have the same dharma. The ultimate dharma is that we are tiny particles of the Supreme, and our dharma is to serve the Supreme in loving devotional service. That's what's necessary for us to do. And we all have that religion. Because it also says in the same Srimad Bhagavatam that dharmam tu shakshat bhagavat praditam. What is the path of dharma? The same word, dharmam tu shakshat bhagavat, it is in fact directly given by the Lord. So we see there are many historical religions, and what the Bhagavatam says is that they are actually given. We cannot make it up. That path is the Lord comes and reveals it to people. Now, why so much diversity? Well, the Lord is one, but the people to whom he reveals it are in all varieties of conditions and circumstances. So he has to give something to which the recipients can relate. So in when there's revelation, there's this element of relativity, according to time and to place and to circumstance. But these should be collected together and understand what is that element of relativity. But there's an element of unity in all of these, in all this diversity, and of absoluteness in all this relativity, because it is coming from the same person. Now, it's true, sometimes someone can claim that they're giving a religion that's coming from God, and it turns out not to be. There's counterfeit everything around, so there's counterfeit dharma. And that's why we can go back to this touchstone that I was quoting, that it has to lead to pure bhakti, loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord, that's free from all selfish motivation, and is also uninterrupted. Ultimately, when there's real dharma, it is none different from our life. Our religion and our life are the same. One time in the 19th century, there was a great English social critic named John Ruskin, and he was asked to address a group of bankers somewhere, and he said to them that you live in one style of architecture and you worship in another. That means you have separated your religion from your life. So mostly that's what has happened in the modern world. So one has to look for these, or progress toward these two things, that I'm serving the Supreme Lord without any motivation, and that I learn how to do this in that I'm doing it 24 hours a day. There's no division between my religion and my life. Now that can be done. And you see, actually, there are those teachings, or steps that leads to those teachings, in all the world great religions. And so if one can come to this this common understanding that this bhakti, I became a disciple of Srila Prabhupada not because I ever thought I was converting to Hinduism. It was a father's thing from my mind. I know people from the outside, oh, you've become a Hindu. But I do not feel like I've become a Hindu. I've just discovered who, well, my dharma is. That is, I've discovered who I really am. And I've discovered my real self, my spiritual identity, through the practice of bhakti. I have a material identity, which is based on, you know, white, American, male, all these kinds of things. But that's temporary and superficial. That's like a suit of clothes you can you have to take off. And you put on another suit and it can be quite different. But the real self is eternal. And that self has this devotional service as its essential nature. That doesn't really change. That's what I have discovered. And I also know that's everybody else's religion. Even though they may belong to some different group or some confessional tradition or whatever. So we've for a number of years I've been engaged, 7 or 8 years now, in a what's called a Vaishnava Christian dialogue. Christian is, you know, one group, the followers of Jesus. And then there are the Vaishnava means, one who worships Vishnu. Okay, so who is Vishnu? The all-pervading person. That's not a Hindu god. That's just the definition of what God is. And so we meet once a year. We read texts together. We read parts of the Bible together with parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We read Saint Bonaventura together with Vishwanath Chakravarti. We read St. Ignatius of Loyola, spiritual exercises with a comparable text from our tradition. And so we really talk about our activities of engaged in of spiritual development. And, you know, we can understand across all these differences of tradition what is going on. When I read the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, I think I read them before I became a devotee, some religion course or somewhere. And I have to confess, at that time I didn't understand a word of it. And then, now that I'm a devotee, I knew exactly what he was talking about. I had this experience when I started practicing devotional service as Prabhupada teaches it. So one thing that I was doing was I shaved my head and put on the traditional dress of a Vaishnava, and I went out in my city every day and stood on a street corner and chanted the Hare Krishna mantra. I chanted the names of God, the glorification of God. Every theistic tradition does this. And we do it on the street corners because we want to help other people. So anyway, as a new devotee, Christians would come up to me and they would tell me that I was serving the devil. They used to give me little pamphlets which claimed that Krishna was a demon who was sent to deceive people. So I would try to argue with them, which was, of course, a waste of my time. But And they said that you know, the devil comes garbed like an angel of light, and he's so clever he can deceive almost anybody. And this is what you're following. And I must confess that at a certain point I started to become paranoid. Because I, you know, in my childhood, I was living in Texas and Oklahoma, and I got a heavy dose of exposure to Bible Belt fundamentalist Christianity, and I didn't really take with it because I didn't care for these people, and I thought they were mostly hypocrites anyway. But nevertheless, because of that, some paranoia came up, and I thought, maybe they're right. How do I know for sure? You know, this totally irrational fear, and it became hard for me. I didn't know how to deal with this fear. And I just said the other devotees, although those people are idiots, forget about them, but there was this thing inside that would go away just because of that. You know, I knew they were idiots, and I tried to forget about them. It didn't happen. So I thought, okay, well, I will sit down and I'll read the four Gospels. And I hadn't done that for a very, very long time. I mean, I was spent quite a few years in philosophy and in graduate school in religion departments, but somehow or other, all during that course of the time, I never sat down and actually read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? Just, I thought, okay, I'll do it, and maybe it might be, you know, that I'll become a Christian. I'll have to give this up. But I just had to do this. So I read it, the New Testament, the four Gospels. I read them, and much to my surprise, for the first time I understood them. I was totally unexpected. I was half expecting to be, you know, taken away from Krishna consciousness or something like that. I could understand so clearly what Jesus was teaching, and it looked to me like he was a person who was trying to teach what I was calling Krishna consciousness, what we're calling Dharma, to people who could barely understand him and had a hard time accepting it. Because, you know, he really wanted also this kind of full commitment and surrender. He said these really heavy things like, let the dead bury the dead and come with me and so on. It sounded like really extreme in some ways what he was saying, but I could appreciate it. You know, and it strengthened my commitment to Krishna consciousness, because I thought that now I was getting exactly what Jesus was teaching, but I was getting it in a way that to me now was clearer and more precisely spoken, and set up in a more systematic philosophical way. There wasn't any fault with Jesus. He was just dealing with the people who he was dealing with. That's all. And you saw what they did to him. So I was quite delighted. And also in the course of time, I also got an answer to say to these people on the streets from the Bible, because. There's one scene, I forgot which gospel it is, where Jesus is driven, somebody's possessed by a demon, and he drives out the demon, and I think puts it into some pigs, which run off a cliff, and then Jesus is accused for doing it. This is of the devil. What you've done is of the devil. And then he makes his famous statement, a house divided against itself will not stand. Will Satan drive out Satan? Mm-hmm. So that was my answer. So the next time somebody came across the street and said, you know, this is of the devil, and I said, you know, because I started chanting Hare Krishna and following this practice, I've given up cigarettes, I've given up marijuana, I've given up LSD, I don't engage in illicit sex, no intoxication. I didn't say meat eating because I know they wouldn't appreciate that. I rise early, I pray all day. I said, is this the work of the devil? I said, a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. This is what the devil does. Mm-hmm. Make people pure, more pious. So that was one of my encounters with this kind of narrow sectarian sort of thing, people who just couldn't understand. I mean, I read the prescriptions, proscriptions in the Gospels also. There in the Gospel of John especially, no other name shall you be saved, and so on. Nevertheless, I could understand. What I had learned in Krishna consciousness was a sufficient philosophical knowledge, theological knowledge of what is Dharma, and how to tell the real from the false. What is the standard by which you can test something? So that we were given the way to discriminate. When Jesus was speaking, he wasn't able to deliver that information at that time. So he said, well, just follow me and forget about everybody else. It's just like when you have a child. You know, if the child's understanding is not sufficient, you just say, just do what I say. You'll be okay. Later, when the child grows up and gets a little more advanced, you can say, well, here's the principle. That you can see who you should associate with and who you shouldn't. And then you apply it. You want to see them be able to stand on their own two feet and apply it. But when they're too young, you can't do that. That was my understanding of how this worked. So people have to understand Dharma. Because of this misunderstanding, there's so much conflict, unnecessary conflict, and division in the world. The human beings need to unify on this platform. You know, we have this idea, you know, of what used to be called the brotherhood of man. Now we have to say the siblinghood of all living beings. We are all of us family members. But if all human beings are brothers and sisters, then that means we have to have a common father and a common mother. Who is the father and who is the mother that we have? If you don't recognize that common source of all of us, then how can you say anything about being brothers or sibling? You can't. It's just rhetoric, empty rhetoric. So people have to have actual experienced knowledge of God. And that to me, which is what made me start this particular practice. I had started by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra to see what would happen. And much to my surprise, I found my material desires beginning to decrease. I realized there was some spiritual potency here. And Prabhupada laid out very, very clearly and showed by his example a sainthood, And I'd always thought of saints as those people in the past who were like this, but Prabhupada made sainthood seem like a viable career goal, a live option, that you could actually do it. And you would think it was impossible, but the more you got to know Srila Prabhupada, the more you said, I want to be like him. And so there was this, strong impetus to take up the path of Krishna consciousness, because it looked like it could be done. And what we mean by it could be done is that one has real relationship, realized knowledge of the Supreme Lord by this practice, that God is not theoretical. During our old 60s days, I remember there was a song of Gracie Slick. She said, one pill makes you larger and one pill makes you smaller. You know the song? Mm-hmm. But the pills your mother gives you don't do anything at all. Well, I'd sat in church pews and been to these different spiritual or religious things, and they didn't do anything. They're the pills. but when Prabhupada came, something happened. He was doing something. And I don't know why. If you actually look at the content of Christianity, that it should do something. And maybe I'm sure that sometimes in some places it is, but nothing which I happen to encounter in my life. But here it was, the path opened with Srila Prabhupada. And I began to practice Krishna consciousness. And the center of the practice is the chanting of the names of God, especially the Hare Krishna mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is a sound that's described as a spiritual sound. They're names of God. They're not names of a Hindu god. They're generic names. Krishna means the most attractive person. By definition, that's what God has to be. Which is great that we focus on that name, because the last thing I'd ever thought of God is that he was attractive. God was always scary. And remote and aloof and unapproachable. But here Krishna says he's the most attractive. That is to say, you'll be attracted to him. God is not repellent. Just the opposite is attractive. Rama means one who feels and who gives the highest bliss. That's generic definition. What God has to be. And Hare is addressed to the energy by which we're united with God. So these are simply as the divine and aspects of the divine that are always there. Nothing foreign, really, nothing strange. But because these are names of God, when you say the name of God, you associate with God, because God and God's name are the same. The absolute, or the realm of the divine, is characterized by non-duality. God and God's name are the same. You can associate with God by chanting his names. God is the supreme pure. Then you say his name, you become purified. So I put it to a test. And I didn't know what to expect. The first time I started chanting was after I heard about it. Some friend of mine brought me to a newly opened temple in 1969, and I was in my third year of graduate school in religious studies. I was going in the mood of an anthropologist, detached, and just to see what was going on, not expecting that these flamboyant people making big displays of themselves and jumping up and down on street corners had anything to teach somebody who was a graduate student and reading Shankaracharya and Hegel and all these things like that. I was a snob. Anyway, I sat and listened to a lecture, and the person who was giving the lecture in a fairly heavy way was talking about the four regulative principles. No eating of meat, fish, or eggs, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling, and pretty strident about it, I thought. And the people around me were really getting turned off. I mean, it was all students and hippies and everything. I was a student hippie too, sort of. But I got interested because I thought, here's somebody telling the truth. Because I had decided after studying different religions for a number of years that I thought that at what seemed to me to be their highest level, they all had a certain thing in common. And that was enunciated very clearly by Buddha. He says that life is suffering, or we'd say material existence, material life is suffering. The cause of the suffering is our desires, our attachments, our cravings. I believe that the life in this world is suffering. I'm absolutely convinced that no prospect for happiness in this world. I have nothing, you know, grossly to complain about in my own life, but I could see it. And I understood that these desires were the cause of this suffering, because we are all trying to hold on to things that are temporary and will cause this suffering. And then Buddha says one has to become free from desire, to extirpate this desire. So I kind of gave it a shot, and no success whatsoever with this. So because the devotee had spoken about these things so bluntly, I became interested. And then he said something which I'd never heard before. He said that if you want to control your senses, you have to give them spiritual engagement. And he said that you have to start with the tongue. And he recommended chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And I thought I would try and see what happened. That was the extent of my faith. Yeah. That I did want to become free from material desires, and I would try chanting and see what had happened. So after the lecture, I went up to somebody and I got a set of these wooden beads for chanting on, and he showed me how to use the beads and how to focus your mind on the sound of the Hare Krishna mantra. And try to pay attention. If your mind wanders, bring it back. And it seemed to me worth trying. I mean, this was a time when many of us were taking pretty powerful chemicals for spiritual realization. So some wood beads and 32 syllables didn't sound like it was such a dangerous thing. So I went home and I started chanting. I don't know how, but maybe I chanted a half an hour a day, but regularly. And I think I must have really put some feeling into it, because I did want to become free from material desires. I saw that the future of the life in the material world is all ends badly. And so I chanted like that, and my material desires began to go away. I didn't see sparks, I didn't see lights, I didn't feel bliss, but I dramatically decreased my material desires. And it was so dramatic that I got frightened, because I realized that this whatever I was doing was very powerful. I didn't know who these people were. I didn't know what to do with myself. I just sit and chant all day. And the other thing was, I have to confess, is that I wanted my material desires to go away, but when they really started to very quickly, I wasn't quite sure yet. So for all those reasons, of mostly being afraid, I stopped chanting after about a week or two. And then I just felt horrible. I just, the greasy cloud rolled over my consciousness, and I realized after a few days that this is terrible. I have to chant. And then cautiously I began chanting. So that was my experience. You see, I didn't have any particular faith in it, just enough to try it and see what happened, and it was effective. What I had to deal with was my own unwillingness maybe to give up some material desires. My faith wasn't, commitment wasn't so strong. And I really didn't understand the whole context. I couldn't just do something. Just because somebody I met in the street said to do it, or some funny person in a robe said to do it. I mean, after all, I was studying theology and philosophy of religion. So when I went to the temple, I got some books. And the first book I read was Prabhupada's translation and commentary on the Isha-Upanishad. And that changed everything. I had studied the Isha-Upanishad a couple of times. And I have to say, nobody knew what it meant. And I could see that I came to the understanding that Prabhupada actually understood the Isha-Upanishad. And in the commentary, he outlined a very, very sophisticated theology. And in fact, it was really first class. I thought that this was professional and everything else I'd ever studied was amateur. Mm-hmm. And yet he did it in this very, very simple English. I was completely awestruck by this book. And that this well-worked-out, sophisticated theology, which actually convinced me that the absolute truth was ultimately a person. For the first time I had a real good, solid theological presentation of this idea, that this theology was in the hands of these people who were jumping up and down on street corners, and it was hard for me to believe that they had this. But they did. But ultimately, because something practical worked, is how I ultimately became involved in it. But by experimental method, I became involved in the practice of bhakti yoga.
I want to double check to make sure that we're... Oh, yeah, good. We've got about maybe 2 minutes left. I wanted to kind of go back to my original point about the ability for you to be able to communicate now with people who are joining together with interfaith purposes, and hopefully you can give us a vision of the possibilities of the future when religions are working together. And
that's a big
hope for that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we do only have, like, as you saw, maybe 2 hours.
Then the program's over, huh?
Yeah.
That's an hour, huh?
Well, this will be 45 minutes.
Okay.
Right. I have 5 minutes before, minutes after, and then I have a few minutes after.
So I got just 2 minutes to do that part, huh?
Yeah. Ravindra, I feel as though I know you much better now than I did, and I'm sure all of our audience as well shares the ideas that you've been sharing with us. I can't help but still be curious about your involvement with the interfaith groupings that you've had, and I'm wondering if there's so much, as you experienced previously with Christians, a move to try and improve one another's validity, or is there actual hope of the people coming together for common purposes? And do you see in the future any changes in the world that can be made if religions are all working together with common goals? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, certainly that's the aim, and I see that things are happening on a positive level. I mean, this is, I'm just a small part of something, but, at least between our Vaishnava Christian group, we've really come to understand each other very well, especially when we talk about practice. You know, there's certain philosophical or theological issues we have to deal with, but when we talk about practice, we understand what each other's doing. The big problem is many people won't sit down and talk. Many people won't sit down and share their spiritual life with each other. They've got barriers. But gradually, I think we're going to have to talk, because one thing that the modern world has done is made us all neighbors. And really, you have to get along with your neighbors. And so I see we're progressing in a good direction. And I'm ultimately hoping, my ultimate hope is not just that everybody gets together on a spiritual platform, but that we can articulate that unity in a science of God, in a science of the soul. According to the Vedas, this is a science. It's experience knowledge. Now, right now, because different religions are there saying different things, you kind of discount it all. But actually, I think we can come to a scientific understanding, and understanding what's absolute and understand what's relative. That's when it's a science, when it's understood as a science, then I think it will be accepted by everybody, not just this faith or that faith, but as truth.
Let's have a check again. What we've got. Oh, that is it.
Okay.
I've got maybe 30 seconds.
Okay. Good luck.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. We're out of time. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Hope you come back.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope you'll come back again.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. My pleasure. Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I hope you can make something out of that.